Sign up today for the Film Comment Letter. It's a free weekly digital newsletter featuring original film criticism and writing by Film Comment's editors and brilliant contributors.
The letter delivers exclusive features, reviews, interviews, streaming picks, news, and more directly to subscribers' inboxes every Thursday before they're published on filmcomment.com the following Monday.
Sign up today at filmcomment.com. Welcome to the Film Comment podcast. I'm Devika Girish, and I'm the co-deputy editor of Film Comment. This year, at the Locarno Film Festival in Switzerland, I participated in a fascinating experimental event called A Long Night of Dreaming About the Future of Intelligence. Curated by Raphael Dernbach in collaboration with the Università della Svizzera Italiana, the event was as strange and wonderful as the title suggests. Beginning at sunset on August 9th and ending at sunrise on August 10th, the event involved a series of talks and workshops that invited guests and attendees to ponder what intelligence means, how artificial intelligence is changing our relationships to ourselves and the world, and how dreams may offer up keys to our future. I was one of the hosts of this event, and today we're sharing an excerpt from my moderating shift featuring a conversation with AI scholar Andrea Rizzoli and critic Kevin B. Lee about the history of artificial intelligence and its limitations and possibilities vis-a-vis art. Check out last week's episode for another excerpt from A Long Night of Dreaming About the Future of Intelligence, featuring Stanford University scholar Shane Denson on the brave new world of post-cinema. I'm so excited to call to the stage the next couple of guests. Please welcome Kevin B. Lee, who is the professor of the future of cinema and audiovisual arts at USI and Locarno Film Festival, as well as the scholar Andrea Rizzoli, who also teaches at USI and works a lot in the field of engineering and AI and modeling and simulation and its application to natural resources, which I'm really excited to get into. But I was wondering if both of you wanted to say some introductory words about what you've heard so far and how your own work applies to this, because you come from very different fields. I'm really curious what this has provoked so far in you.
Oh, certainly a lot. But I feel that as the Locarno Film Festival professor, it's my duty to remind all of us that we're in a film festival and that, thinking about intelligence, and so far the conversation has been very much rooted in the question of artificial intelligence, which, Andrea, you're going to give us a deeper historical and also contemporary ethical and cultural insight. I want to somehow find a way to make space for what I'd like to call cinematic intelligence. And I think Devika and I, we've talked a bit about certain films and things here in the festival, and thinking about the role that cinema plays in conveying a certain intelligence that's articulated through the language of cinema. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the language of cinema, let's talk about the language that is really bringing a lot of hype and attention in the last year. And Andrea, you've been researching artificial intelligence for like 35 years. So it's quite a radical, epochal transformation of public awareness and interest in your work. So could you say...
I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about the different terms that have been used for this concept. I mean, 35 years ago, was it called artificial intelligence?
Yes, it was. Okay. So the reason I'm here is basically because I'm coordinating and directing the Dalle Molle Institute for Artificial Intelligence, which is a research institute of both USI and SUPSI, and it has been founded 35 years ago. Despite I'm quite old, I was there in 1988, but I've been through the history of the institute for long enough to tell you a few things about how artificial intelligence has evolved through the years. The term artificial intelligence has been coined in Dartmouth College during a conference in 1950, something like that. But the idea of artificial intelligence comes from thousands of years ago. The Greeks were fascinated by automata, and they were able to build machines that were displaying the same some sort of autonomous behavior in regulating, for instance, the opening of doors or some gods that were appearing on temples and these type of things. But clearly the technology wasn't ready for providing these manifestation of autonomous behavior with what we would deem intelligence. We can wait some other thousands of years to get the automata that were developed also in Switzerland by the clockmakers, mm-hmm. and they are very fine pieces of machinery, but they are totally deterministic. They respond to a predetermined series of instructions mm-hmm. they can repeat to infinity. And they are, again, not what we would define intelligence. Mm-hmm. I think the term artificial intelligence has been very appropriate for the 50s when the first emulation of the behavior of our brain were realized through the perceptron. That was an electronical circuit that represented the inner structure of the brain with the neuron, the axon, in order to be able to reproduce the type of triggerings that we getting our brain, our cells, through the electrical stimuli. And these machines were very simple with respect to what we have today. And there was the problem that weren't able basically to classify complex phenomena and distinguish nonlinear situation like current neural networks are. So there was a crisis in AI, and that was around the 80s, just after the Dalemol Institute has been founded. So people switched to a different type of artificial intelligence, that one that Gala was displaying before, ELISA, for instance. Mm-hmm. ELISA is a rule-based system. You have a set of programmatic rules, if-then-elses, and then the program goes through them. And it gives you the impression of understanding you, being able to interact with you as Gala demonstrated. You give an input, tell me more about that. Do you think you have a problem with your family? Tell me something more about that. But actually, it is just a manifestation of something that is not really there. Mm-hmm. Then, here it comes the moment where ITSIA became important, because ITSIA, fortunately, is quite relevant on a worldwide level, because the research of Jürgen Schmidhuber, that is a professor at TUSI and at KAUST, now in Saudi Arabia, were able to solve a problem with the training of deep neural networks, that one that are used, for instance, also in transformers like these GPT and ChatGPT, and basically they are everywhere. These deep neural networks are basically the same structure that was invented by Minsky many years ago, the perceptron, but with multiple layers with thousands of parameters. And the problem is that these systems learn by examples. You show a picture of a cat and tell, this is a cat. You show a picture of a dog, this is a dog, and then you show thousands of cats, thousands of dogs, and then they learn to distinguish between what is a cat, what is a dog. Mm-hmm. The problem is that when the networks were large enough with a classical structure, after a while, I can't enter the detail of the training algorithm, but basically it was not possible to increment the predictive capability of the network. Schmidhuber and his colleagues invented a new structure of the network that was recurring using past information and that was able also to process information over time. And this was fundamental to solve this problem of training these networks and also for processing sequences. Sequences means speech, means text, means videos. And so this is why if you have an Android phone, the algorithm that is understanding your voice has been actually developed here in Ticino for the first time. So this is quite surprising. Many people don't know that. Mm. And
can you say what you mean by processing over time? What does that mean? Like storing memory?
When you are processing speech or text, to be able to predict the next phoneme, you need to understand what is the sequence of the previous phonemes.
Okay.
And this can be something very simple. Mm-hmm. If you want to do a prediction over a few instances, but it can be very complex, like we see in Transformers nowadays. Mm-hmm. ChatGPT is based on this pre-trained generative transformer, mm-hmm. and it is a model that builds on some pre-existing mechanism mm-hmm. That uses these type of structures. Mm-hmm. And the major breakthrough actually happened when GPUs were made available, mm-hmm. because Schmidhuber made this discovery in the 90s, and the computational power was not there yet. In 2010, around that year, 2010, 2012, GPUs that were originally invented for computer graphics.
What is a GPU?
Graphical processing unit. Mm-hmm. In all of our computers, in the mobile phones, now we have GPUs. Mm-hmm. And they were quite fancy at the time, and they were invented for video games. But then researchers discovered that they could use them to implement in a parallel way these complex algorithms. And so it was possible to process huge amount of data and to make deep neural networks process data in a superhuman way. Superhuman means with abilities that are superior to what we as human do. But this was limited to very narrow tasks like image classification, as I was telling you, mm-hmm. speech processing. This was before the advent of pre-trained generative models that are able to process text, mm-hmm. and that is much more similar to what we feel to be an intelligent type of behavior as humans. Mm-hmm. But the question that we can ask ourselves now, are these machines now really intelligent? Mm-hmm. I mean, instead of thousands of parameters like the deep neural networks, now they have billions. Mm. And they have a complexity that is similar to our brains. Mm. But are they intelligent in the way that we are?
Well, I guess I did want to ask, what is the technical definition of intelligence in your field? What is an intelligent machine?
Yeah, I mean, there are many different definitions, but basically they are mostly based on an input-output. I mean, The classical definition is the Turing test, invented by the mathematician Alan Turing in the 30s. You know, and it says, basically, if you put a machine behind a door and in another room you put a human, you ask the same questions to the machine and you get the answers, are you able to distinguish the machine from the human? This is a classical example mm-hmm. of a test to a definition of artificial intelligence. If the machine is able from the outside perspective to act like a human, then you say, okay, this is an intelligent machine. But I think that we give a different meaning to intelligence in the sense that we have autonomy, in the sense of having free will, intention to do, mm-hmm. Sentience, consciousness, a number of other things that currently are not present in these machines. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, these qualities are quite important for a machine to be able to be, for instance, creative, because we can ask a machine to produce a painting in the style of Van Gogh, mm-hmm. and they can generate these paintings. But can we ask this machine to invent a new painting style?
But when you when you associate intelligence with something like free will, earlier we were talking about intelligence in animals or other species besides humans. And so this question of using an animal paradigm like crows or dolphins, animals that have demonstrated behaviors that humans can recognize as intelligent, but also what about animals that behave in ways that we may not perceive as intelligent, but might have an intelligence of their own? So, you know, free will is a very human concept. I don't know if you would attribute free will to chimpanzees or other animals. Like, how do we define it?
Well, this is a too difficult question for me, definitely. The point is that there are so many different types of intelligence as we're discussing. We have also emergent type of intelligence, like ant colonies, which also inspired other type of algorithms. They have a sort of emergence intelligence. Then you could attribute intention to the colony, but not to the single ant. Mm. So, is intelligence and consciousness an emergent property of a structure that could be the structure of our mind or the structure of a machine? Mm-hmm. For the moment, I don't think we know. Maybe in the future, with more computational power and with ability of these machines to interact with the real world, because now these machines display some sort of artificial consciousness that we attribute to them, but they don't have, because they're just regressing on past information.
Right.
But they don't learn from the real world. They learn from text. They learn from data that is textual. If they learn from interacting with the real world, like an embodied AI could do, would they demonstrate an emergent property like intelligence? This is the question.
So right now, intelligence is perfect simulation, the ability to simulate a human as close to perfection as possible. But I think because we don't know the limits to human intelligence, it's maybe hard to draw a boundary around what intelligence could constitute in a machine or an object, right? I mean, because human intelligence isn't definable.
Absolutely not.
And if the something like the Turing test is based on the on an idea of what human intelligence means, which is impossible to nail down, I kind of want to, you know, you brought up this like really great question of can AI produce new art? And I think like we have been talking about glitches, and I think there is a way in which AI could create something that doesn't exist. But can it create something we would recognize as beautiful? Can AI recognize beauty? I mean,
well,
yes.
again, Schmidhuber developed a theory of beauty and that is totally mathematical. So is, and I think this dates back to the Greek again. You know, they had the theory of beauty based on the golden ratio, the perfect proportion, and it wrote this algorithm that could classify the beautifulness of a face. And it worked quite well. I think that's possible. But I don't think that you can quantify beauty.
Right, because I think maybe with you could quantify like the attractiveness of a face or something based on how people react with the face. But for example, when you look at certain paintings like Impressionists or something, it stirs something in you. And I'm being very abstract here because we're talking about beauty, but I feel like there is an experience of beauty, of the sublime, that is not conditioned socially. And what a mathematical conception of beauty relies on socially conditioned ideas of beauty. And I guess I'm trying to like kind of make a bridge to maybe cinema here too, because I was thinking when looking at, for example, the video that Shane showed us, that it digital images just look ugly. And I don't know if that is because they don't look like reality. I mean, I don't know if realism and simulation comes into it. So I don't know if the ability to create beauty has to also do with simulation. But I don't know. Is can beauty be reconstructed in the way that intelligence can,
well,
I guess?
You're provoking so many that I will need some time to to reply also to Kevin. But there are a few things I want to say. First of all, is that I think that an AI could generate something that we haven't seen before, even based on past data. But the AI cannot explain why it or she or he created that thing. If you take the Impressionists, they had a clear idea of what they wanted to do with their technique. And they could explain the reason behind that. If you take the guy, I forgot the name, that painted that black painting that is on show in Basel, and it was totally black. Okay, so everybody can do that. But it's the idea, it's the concept. And so you need the consciousness and the intention to do something. And then this might not, I mean, it's not beautiful. It is a concept. It is art because it has an idea behind that. Okay. So this is something that, in my opinion, you can trust an AI that is unconscious to do this. And yeah, this is one point. And the other thing is that the quantification of beauty, again, it's pretty impossible because it depends on how we perceive it, and it is very subjective. And therefore, mathematics can give you a first classification that is maybe something objective, but in my opinion, beauty is very subjective.
Well, it makes me wonder that the more that these algorithms are able to replicate established and recognizable works of art like a Van Gogh or a Picasso, does that diminish their value since they can be replicable? Like the way I see it, the more that these iconic images and aesthetics can be replicated, they really start to enter the language of banality. And I find myself desiring images that I can't find through algorithms. So that's just maybe more of a statement or a response.
But I think I would maybe react with what Andrea just said, which is a Van Gogh is not special to me. A painting is not special because I can't find it online. It's special because Van Gogh made it at a certain point and he was a certain kind of artist.
Yeah.
And so there is a contextual element to why we value art that I don't think has to do with reproducibility. You know, I mean, I know Walter Benjamin and all of this idea of what mechanical reproduction robs of art. And I think that is a different question from what you're asking, because that is a question of value, not of our appreciation of art. Does the value of a painting go down if people can reproduce it? I don't know. People can reproduce paintings pretty well now, and people still pay millions of dollars for originals. Yeah. So, like, the economy of value will always find ways to preserve, you know, the value of art objects, of speculative objects, I think. And I think, and that is different from something like an appreciation of history. I mean, ultimately, a moment that has passed cannot be reproduced. I mean, so far, I don't know. Maybe we'll get to a place where that happens. So at least my appreciation isn't calibrated by...
Yeah, like a deeply embedded human context of understanding and appreciation. Yeah. I want to offer an anecdote related to the film festival and algorithms about a desire of mine to... well, if not reproduced, to produce an event that was supposed to happen but didn't happen, because as you all know, there's the SAG Actors Union strike that has had an impact on the festival, because certain guests such as Cate Blanchett and Riz Ahmed and Stellan Skarsgård, who were expected to attend the festival, have declined to do so. And I was supposed to be the moderator for a talk with Riz Ahmed upon his receiving a Career Achievement Award, and it was my chance to meet one of my heroes, and I was really heartbroken. So I kind of gave in to a little algorithmic fantasy temptation, like not quite my own version of replica. I used this engine called Runway ML, which is a text-to-video generator. So forget about DALL-E, it's not just about text-to-image. Now you can do text-to-video. And so I put in... Kevin B. Lee and Riz Ahmed on stage having a talk at the Locarno Film Festival. I wish I could show you the image right now, but it's almost better to imagine it. So it spat out an image of two figures that kind of look like Riz Ahmed talking to each other. So does that mean, and I'm trying to understand the logic of the algorithm. Does that mean that Kevin B. Lee does not exist in its image set?
Its corpus.
Yeah, I'm a nobody, and you know, Riz Ahmed's worth
two people. Aren't you doing the very thing that actors are trying to stop students from doing? Creating AI avatars to replace their physical...
Well, this is what happens when they don't show up. I don't know. I mean, but it's also an experiment to understand what are the capabilities and the implications. So I am kind of using myself as a guinea pig. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't see myself in any form, it gave me the option to upload an image of myself to help train the algorithm. And I gave in and did that. And so then I put in the prompt again, Kevin B. Lee and Riz Ahmed on stage at the Locarno Film Festival. And this time, it spat out one person on stage who looked like the adult child of Riz Ahmed and Kevin B. Lee.
I would like to see this child.
So I don't know. I don't know if you're able to diagnose this or make sense of it. And I'm part of me is asking myself, okay, am I just doing this wrong? What are the best practices? How do I get the results I want?
What algorithm did you use? I mean, what's
it's just Runway ML. But you know, on the other hand, what you were saying about the beauty of glitches, I actually appreciate these glitches as an opportunity to critically perceive and diagnose how these algorithms may or may not be working, because I think that is probably more valuable than having your fantasies fulfilled. And that's why I feel comfortable disclosing this story. One more thing I'll add, one more detail, is that I did look up the best practices for Runway ML. And there's one keyword that they suggest you using to get the best results, and it's the word cinematic. That cinematic is a prompt for generating a best result.
Wow. We should dig into that. But I want to hear, Andrea, your reaction.
My reaction is... I don't know the details of Run ML. It's a tool I haven't used personally. But I'm quite sure that in a couple of years at maximum, you will be able to do the same exercise and get perfect results. Because these tools are making progress that is quite incredible, thanks to the increase in the quality of the data, in the computational capabilities, in the power.
But if Kevin never had an image uploaded to the internet, then that program would never succeed, right? No matter how sophisticated.
Clearly. If it doesn't know who Kevin Billy is, it will never be possible to have a real Kevin Billy. But think as a human, what would you do? Kevin Billy, I don't know this guy. I can imagine, I can put anybody that could presumably like Kevin Billy. That is a person that is of, I don't know, I could assume of American accent, and I got it probably wrong because you're Asian-American. So, but it would be a good attempt. But I want to bring the discussion now on the data, on the quality of the data that we are using to train these tools. Because this is the key issue. And if you don't have data that is of high quality, well-structured, aptly tokenized to train these tools, then they don't basically work. And the major effort that companies like OpenAI and Microsoft are doing right now is in curating the data and also curating the type of output that is produced by these tools to produce to provide some reinforcement to some behaviors and punishing other behaviors that are undesirable. And this opens up a number of ethical issues because we do not know which data sets they are using to train these models. These we were discussing with Kevin before of ImageNet. That was one of the first data sets that we could use to train these deep neural networks for image classification. And after a while, this data set was retracted because it contained images that were biased, polarized, misrepresenting people, religions, and these type of things. Now we're all very well aware about the implications of using data sets that are not appropriately curated. But now that these models are in the hands of corporations, how can we as citizens be sure of the quality and the fairness of these data sets? And the fact that Kevin Billy will be able to use these tools, having his own image represented in a fair and appropriate way.
There is a website that you can use as a way of perceiving what images have been used to train these AI algorithms. It's called haveibeentrained.com, a platform designed by two artists, Holly Herndon and Matt Dreihurst, based in Berlin. And they designed it as a way for artists to be able to detect if their own copyrighted artistic creations have been absorbed without their consent, without their permission, into these training sets. Yeah, this question of image sets is interesting. I mean, I'm also curious about, another experiment, which I don't know if I should disclose, but again, feeling the Locarno heartbreak vibes of red carpet
just
celebrities not being able to make it.
Saying is going to be sucked up by a new
I am a professor. I'm here to do research that, yeah. So what I did
when I put in a query, say something Kevin Beeley would come up. So.
Yeah. So I was, because when Cate Blanchett declined to attend the Locarno Film Festival, I was curious what she would have to say. I imagine, what if she was one of the featured speakers in this event? What would she have to say about AI? So I put in, Cate Blanchett at the Long Night of Intelligence talking about AI. What would she say? And what came out was that she said, AI has been a fantastic game changer for my career. Because, for example, recently I was in a production where they utilized this algorithmic responsive lighting design that was trained to optimize the lighting setups with every change of my facial expressions, which I find rather fascinating. Like, can you imagine a real-time lighting and camera scheme that's responsive? Never mind that we might be eliminating certain jobs of cinematographers and lighting specialists. But what left me a bit troubled was that this was such a unique and distinct and conspicuous idea, but it had no attribution to where this idea may have come from and who's involved in it. Mm-hmm. And I find this really troubling because it's like, okay, these are ideas. This is intellectual property. And there's no way in this in ChatGPT to be able to trace where these ideas come from.
Yeah, absolutely. This will be another major issue for research, the ability to provide transparency and causal explanation to the reasoning that these models are doing. Currently, causality in neural networks is an open topic, which you're very interested in researching. But the causal explanation that you could get from tools like ChatGPT very often make very little sense. So this is one of the problems that we will have to definitely solve, especially if you think of real-world application. I mean, we're all having fun with ChatGPT, asking, okay, write me a resume and so on. That when you use this tool for medical diagnosis, for instance, then it becomes quite tricky.
Yeah. Another thing that doesn't quite make sense is faces at times, because when I did the Riz Ahmed search, it produced faces that looked kind of Riz Ahmed-ish, but not quite. And I've noticed this quite a few times, that faces and hands don't produce so realistically.
Yeah, but I mean, for instance, Midjourney had the same problem, but the recent releases has improved the ability to draw hands. And if you look at some of the photos that is able to generate, they're very, very high quality. Reproducing the fake videos that we see around are of extremely high quality. And the fact that you can sample a few seconds of a people's voice and then being able to reuse it, this means that you can really generate information that is fake, but totally undistinguishable from reality. And this is another thing that we was discussing with some colleagues. How do we bring back trust into news? And as a consequence, the fact that we are going to generate lots of information that is, excuse my French, bullshit, this information will be fed back into the system and used to train models that will build their knowledge on this biased and fake information. And after a while, the information content is going, that will be produced by these tools, will be practically nothing. So this is a major risk in using these type of tools with no discrimination.
I wonder, I mean, is what we want a change in the tools or a change in our paradigms of what is truth and evidence? Because with each technological development, from writing to recording to something like Photoshop, digital images, our ideas, even on a juridical level, like legal level, our ideas of what counts as evidence, you know, what counts as a truth claim have changed. Can we stop this kind of the ability? Or so is it more about building structures of knowledge and trust, like you're saying?
Well, there are two things. One thing is that, no, we cannot stop this because this already happened, for instance, when photography was invented and then the photos were doctored in the Soviet Union. They were removing people from photos and rewriting history. So We've seen this happening. This is going to happen in the future. And secondly, yes, we could build a new type of chain of trust in reputable sources and using tools like a blockchain to trust people that have seen, for instance, an interview with Zelensky. Like now, you see there are many fake Zelensky interviews, but you could have journalists that are there when you speak, and journalists that are accredited, and these journalists could relay the news to another colleague through a sort of secure channel over a blockchain, and then you could have reputable sources that are trusted, that on which you can rely for instance. This is just an idea, but there will be solutions to a problem that we know. And we will have to use our own common sense to distinguish what is true and what is not. Maybe in the past, everything that was written on newspaper was taken for granted. Now we know that we can't trust everything that is written on newspaper.
Well, it's funny because a lot of the way in which technology evolved was to correct for human tendency to lie or the ability to lie, right? So a person can lie in court, and that's why you have photographic evidence. And now what you're talking about is the exact reverse of that. Photos can lie, so now we need to trust humans. But yeah, I mean, it feels like this like epistemic like crisis, you know. I don't know what exactly the way out is, but I think that what you're saying does get back to this. I think that at some point we got to a place with technologies of capture where we felt like we can have perfect control of the world, right? Like the world could be perfectly verifiable, recordable. And maybe what we're confronting now is that that was always a fantasy. And that is a fantasy that has fed incredibly authoritarian and corporate structures, but it was always a fantasy, right? And I mean, that's always been the question of surveillance. If you just record everything, will crime not happen? And that's never been the case. And I think, like, in a way, what you're describing, Andrea, is making me think, like, what we're confronting is actually human society runs on really basic things like trust and shared resources and investing in each other's well-being.
And yes, I mean, we are a society, and therefore we have also to have multiple views, but these multiple views needs to be weighted, integrated, and then you have multiple sources of information. You have to attribute different weights to different sources of information, and we have to exercise the same type of reasoning that you have when you hear your friends talking about maybe another friend, and they might have different opinions. So you have your own, and then you put them together and you give some. I mean, this type of mechanism are valid at the local and at global level after all. But we are, I think, escaping a bit the main focus of... because if we are talking about the future of intelligence, now we are talking about the future of information. And the future of intelligence, it's maybe even more complex than this.
Well, you know, the future of information is going to rely on human intelligence, like new methods of human discernment and human ability to read images, read information, and how do we create the structures and the systems for programming ourselves to counter-program the algorithmic reality that's being produced for us.
Yeah, and this is what we were discussing before, the fact that I think that we're using just a very little tiny part of our brain in a sense that we would deem as intelligence. Most of the use of our brain is for basic, functional, essential things. That is, apart from our own living, like walking, doing, eating, these type of things. But even when we write, we elaborate, we process information, we are using some sort of basic processing things. We are not really reflecting. We don't have time to do that. And maybe these AI tools will be able to take away a bit of the burden from our lives and give us more time to really think about what we want and to plan things more thoroughly, to evaluate the counterfactuals, like what happens if that thing had not happened. This type of reasoning that is at a much deeper level that we very rarely exercise. So this is the opportunity, I think, that we have, is to use these tools as tools to co-evolve our intelligence to a higher level.
Well, I'd certainly like to think of a film festival as being a space for having that moment to press pause on this algorithmic accelerationism that's just rushing us into a future that we may not be able to control.
Speak for yourself. I have watched 21 movies in the last week.
Okay, let's talk about some of these movies, because there are two movies that come to my mind in thinking about examples of cinematic intelligence, this thing I threw out a moment ago, as an answer to this algorithmic dystopia that we've been describing. And these two films are Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World by Radu Jude and The Human Search 3 by Eduardo Williams. And thinking about it and listening to you now, it dawns on me that these two films offer two different strategies of how to confront an algorithmic reality. That Radu Jude's film, I would say, is the cinema of transparency. Like, it really is presenting an approach of exposing underlying realities and histories that are masked by a reality that's being produced by capitalism. Mm-hmm. What I mean by this, I don't know if I have time to go through the entire synopsis, but it basically comes down to a public service or a safety video that a company is producing, exploiting a worker who had been injured on the job as a kind of inspirational figure and cautionary tale to instruct other employees to wear their safety helmets. But as they're filming this safety video, it comes to light that there's a completely different reality to this workplace injury that really puts the company at fault. And I think the shot takes what, like half an hour? Like, how long is
maybe
this?
Maybe more. It's the film's final shot is right. The shooting of this ad. But before we get into that, Kevin, I think what is maybe when you talk about cinematic intelligence and the use of digitality and artificiality in that film is that there's a running gag where the protagonist, who is this freelance worker for this ad company, lives in her car. So she just goes everywhere in her car. She's kind of a really kind of precarious hustler, as people might say. And she does the series of videos, Instagram videos, right, where she wears this filter, which gives her eyebrows, a bald head, and a beard. And she basically pretends to be like an Andrew Tate fan. Yeah. So she's like, she creates little parodies of videos made by him and other, you know, really horrible, toxic men on the internet. And she says a bunch of racist and sexist things. And what's really interesting about the film and Radu Jude's work is that it is critique through embodying the thing. Mm-hmm. So, like, the film is full of people saying really racist shit without necessarily a moment of, like, someone saying, hey, this is bad. Yeah. So it asks us to find a critique in, like, the embodiment of the thing by making it really crude through the use of duration, all of that. And that particular, the character's use of this filter to just say these nasty things, she just says them. And people are like, you know, you're going to get in trouble. People are going to think you mean these things. And she says, it's satire, you know? And actually, kind of the only thing that makes it satire is that the filter she uses is really bad. It's glitchy. So every time she turns her face, the filter doesn't work so you can see her face. And then it's just like this awful little digital composite. Mm. And that is actually how a lot of internet, Instagram, social media satire works these days, right?
Through the
glitches. It takes advantage of the imperfection of these simulations. And I think that is something that has some larger cinematic value in what Jude is getting at. Like, if we think of intelligence, Andrea, as you were saying earlier, as a kind of the ability to perfectly simulate a human, that is something filmmakers like Jude are like the broken simulation. Absolutely. Is where we can start to find critique.
Yeah, critique and art, yeah. I'll also mention what I meant by the cinema of opacity with Teddy Williams, The Human Search 3, because this is using
the film at Locarno, he has a feature called The Human Search 3, which is the sequel to The Human Surge, which There is no.
And there is no Human Search 2.
Yeah.
I don't know if we need to explain that, but it's using a 360-degree camera, which I associate as surveillance technology. I think it's a similar kind of image capture that Google Maps would use, right? Mm-hmm. But what's fascinating is that it deploys this camera in multiple sites around the world, and it moves through these spaces alongside groups of young people. But it doesn't capture or pin them down. They kind of move alongside and through and often off screen. And the soundtrack is very rich with voices that we cannot pinpoint to people. So it's kind of like a counter geolocation cinema. It's actually resisting the apparatus of surveillance that this technology is supposed to enable. And I find it completely disorienting at times, but in a way that's oddly liberating. And so this is what I mean by the cinema of opacity, like the political power of not being perceptible, not being measurable, of resisting the algorithm.
And I think what's interesting is that what the film is doing is showing how complete capture often is unintelligible. If you record everything and show everything, it is not intelligible. If you're listening and you're able to see everything. And so what cinema does is work against like completion. It's the art of cutting space and time into digestible units. And I think that is really kind of fantastic in that film. But it's also, it composites these different locations together. So like China and Sri Lanka and these people together. And it looks, there are glitches, but sometimes it is very convincing. I mean, sometimes I was like, did he really fly these people out to China? Or is this some kind of composite? And it just produces this sense of really powerful uncertainty that feels both really, I mean, it gives you a sense of possibility, like
absolutely
how you can imagine.
It reminds me of what it was like to use the internet in the 90s. Like, oh my God, I can connect to people around the world.
Right.
And something's been lost in the last 20 years or so. That feeling of the preciousness and the amazing like value of being able to connect with people around the world. We take it for granted now. And this film somehow repositions that proposition in a way that really strikes you.
But I think it would not affect me similarly if this was an immersive VR experience. So if I felt, because it's two-dimensional in how you consume it, there is something remarkable about seeing all of these people composited. But if I was in that space, I think that I would not feel that magic. I mean, obviously it's a subjective experience because then it is, I guess it's simulating experience. And here it's not simulating my experience. It is simulating fantasy, really, right? It's simulating like an image I may have in my head, not my experience. And I thought that that was very interesting.
Yeah, but withholding complete immersion and completion and that fantasy of having the thing that you're wanting.
Right.
And somehow that pushing back just makes you appreciate it on its own terms. It's a certain autonomy that the film holds in itself.
But also because a movie is always like an image of the past. So it feels complete. Whereas like if you're immersed in a VR environment, you have this feeling of contingency. And what makes movies beautiful is they are pre-constructed. You consume something that's been made already. It is complete. It is bounded, you know, and that is a very reassuring feeling. And part of the fear of AI is like the absolute unpredictability, right? Like,
and the constant producing. I mean, you know, we're no longer beholden to things that have been, pre-produced. Well, the thing is, AI is a bit pre-produced because it's using data sets, but it's always generating something that seems new. And it's always, it's like, what do you call it? Hitting the slot machine. You're always getting a new result. And it's like, wow, what's it going to do now? What's it going to do now? What's it going to do now? And I feel like we're in a generation that's in the process of being mass hypnotized by this constantly producing algorithm. And we no longer value things that just are or have been.
It's an interesting reflection. I think that the value of a movie or a novel or any representation is that it works a lot like our brain, because when we remember things, We select them and we place them in a specific order, and we remember only relevant things. So we build our own script in our mind, if you think about a distant event in your past. And the brain is quite a funny thing, and I don't think that we know very well how it works yet.
Maybe we need to focus more on the brain, rather the human brain, rather than the algorithm.
Probably, yes.
I think on that note, we will end this conversation. Thank you so much. I feel like this was an amazing lesson on AI. Like, I learned so much, but we also managed to go in so many different directions.
The Film Comment podcast features original music by Greg Einge. Film Comment is a publication of Film at Lincoln Center. Since 1962, Film Comment has been the home of independent film journalism, publishing in-depth interviews, critical analysis, and feature coverage of mainstream, arthouse, and avant-garde filmmaking from around the world. Visit us online at filmcomment.com.